Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Rick Bass has been writing about the natural world for decades and been celebrated for it. His new book, he says, is for posterity, to tell people 100 years from now what the wilderness was like. He records in lush detail 1 year of his family's life in Montana's Yaak Valley, from winter blizzards to summer fires, rain and berries, deer and bears, butterflies and wildflowers. At the center of it all, Rick himself, his wife, their children. This hour On Point, Rick Bass and the Montana Wild. You can join the conversation. Have you been to the Yaak Valley in Montana? Have you ever wanted to pick up and move out somewhere where you'd be closer to the natural world? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Spokane, Washington, is Rick Bass. He's a critically acclaimed writer, author of over 20 books, novels, memoirs, short stories, and nature writing, including The Book of Yaak, The Lives of Rocks, and Why I Came West. He's also a committed voice for conservation of the country's wilderness. His new book is The Wild Marsh, Four Seasons at Home in Montana. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rick Bass, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me in.
So help us understand where you are out there. Where exactly is the Yaak Valley?
It's the farthest northwest corner of the state. It's right up on the British Columbia border and the Idaho border.
And how long have you been there?
I moved up here in 87.
In your book, you say you grew up in the petrochemical suburbs of Houston, Texas, in the 1960s. So how did you come to settle in the Yaak?
I think because I grew up in the petrochemical corridor of Houston. you know, I just knew that there was something different and something other than that. I didn't know what it was, but that was enough.
What did it turn out to be?
You know, space. Texas is such a funny state. It's half southern and half western, and you're growing up in this southern culture, but there's this myth or ethos of open space and frontier and undiscovered or relatively unregulated lives farther on, farther west. And you know, I think I grew up with that imagery, and then just went looking for it a landscape with just more space.
Mm. In the book, you describe in beautiful detail the old homestead that you inhabit. You bought it, in fact, saved it from being cut down, cleared out. Describe for us where you live, how you live.
Sure. The Yaak Valley, it's a very wonderful place for a number of reasons, but one of the things that fascinates me is nobody's ever lived there. Even the native people would just hunt there, in summer and fall, but didn't have any year-long encampments there. And as a result, it's really only been inhabited, year-round for about 100 years or so. We bought this old homestead that was way back on a marsh, on a swamp. There's no electricity where we are. There was not a phone line, no nothing, just totally off the grid. Very wild, lush, rich, swampy place.
Have you since added electricity and phones service?
We have solar panels and a generator and batteries. And yes, we did lay an old dial-up line in from the main road, which is about 7 miles away.
And your writing. Tell me the process of that and where physically you actually write.
Sure. I took that old homestead, it was just an old cabin with a root cellar, apart and dragged the logs one by one down a little closer to the marsh, and then set the cabin back up in this little blind, this little bower of alder and cottonwood and aspen, where it looks right out at the marsh, and that's where I do my work. And so I look out at that same window at the same marsh, every day.
Some reviewers have actually compared your book to Walden, Thoreau's great work. I'm curious what you think first of the comparison.
You know, it's obviously it's a flattering comparison, but I wonder a lot what the great Eastern writers from 100 and 200 years ago would have made of the West. So many great Eastern writers and thinkers have been fascinated by the allure and idea of the West, and the West means something quite different to Americans. And I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, really wanted to get West. Thoreau wanted to get West. So many great thinkers and writers have, and you know, in this day and age, we have the luxury in this culture of being able to move West if we want to with relative ease.
And yet, has the idea of holing up or hunkering down against the world sort of lost its allure since Thoreau did it?
Well, it sure hasn't for me. I can't speak for everybody, but I wouldn't think so. I think that's always going to be, you know, a deep allure for a certain percentage of our population, no matter what our culture. I just think that's, you know, hardwired into some of us.
When you think about Thoreau and how he lived, in reality, he lived only a few minutes away from somebody, from his mother, with whom he had lunch often. I mean, where you are, people live miles and miles away. Do you have friends? Do you socialize?
It is a long way from folks, from friends or even folks who aren't friends. It's just a long way. And, you know, lunch is a big deal. You hardly ever just call up and say, hey, come on over for lunch. You'll set it up a week in advance, and it's a nice big deal.
What's it like in the valley right now, this time of
year? It's really sweet. It's this beautiful, flat, really sweet time of year. It's still green. You know, spring has only been here a very short while. Incredible bird life, incredible insect activity. All the babies have been born and are starting to move around. My youngest daughter, Lowry, and I, we saw this huge lion run across the road last night. It's a really active time for predators, for prey, and yet it's not too hot yet, and the fires haven't started, so it's not smoky. It's still a short while after the solstice, so the days are still really, really long, and they start really early, and the nights are cold. It's fantastic. I always forget how wonderful this stretch is.
It is a wonderful stretch. Take us back to January, and if you would, read for us from your book, The Wild Marsh.
Would sure. You? Yes, thanks. It seems like something from a fairy tale. Such a soft, heavy, calming snow, one of the heaviest and most beautiful snowfalls I've ever seen. And how wonderful it seems, if this evening is somehow near the end of the old world as we knew it, that end should come not in fire or chaos, but with silent, beautiful burial. We're all becalmed. We all feel joy. All the year's despairs, and there have been many, who among us does not carry them in great quantity these days, feel swept clean, or even better than that, not merely hidden or absolved, but transformed, covered with beauty, converted to beauty, as if all failure or disappointment or hunger or absence has been redeemed. I go back outside to check on the generator and then stand in the falling snow for a long time. I haven't felt this happy in a good long while, and best of all, I'm happy for no reason. I go back inside with an inch or more of snow on my shoulders from just the brief time spent outside. We continue to browse on the bounty of food, to drink and joke and visit. All of our discussions are of the future, our hopes, our certainty of joy. We play board games, games of skill and chance, all night and on toward the gray morning.
I love that passage because you mention joy and happiness. I'm happy for no reason, you say. Can you describe that a little more, that feeling? Does that come often for you?
It's a tough one to describe. I guess it's a shame on us for it catching us by surprise when you are suddenly aware of this, you know, this joy and happiness surrounding you in all directions, and it surprises you that there's not a reason for it. I mean, I think it really doesn't speak well to where we are, you know, as a species or as a culture. It just radiates and just, you know, I don't know where it comes from, and I guess that's part of the goodness of it. What I will say, and you know, the Yak is a land of four seasons, four very distinct seasons, and some go really quickly and some go really slow. And I think adjusting yourself or being adjusted to those paces and rhythms has something to do with it. It's almost as if, you know, there's some force beyond yourself saying, okay, now it's your time to step up and be happy here or be joy-filled. And then, again, that same force can kind of, you know, shove you into the shadows and say, okay, you know, time to step back here and be somber or think about something. It's almost, you know, beyond your control, kind of a wildness, and not a bad wildness in that rhythm.
Comes from somewhere deep, sounds like.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, if it comes from within, it's from some place way deep, yeah. I happen to think it comes from a little bit beyond. The landscape is so powerful up here. I don't think we're the, you know, kind of the central mover in it. I think it's more of a relationship between us and the landscape.
You mentioned the landscape. You also mentioned the creatures that you see every day outside your window come and go. Can you give us a list? You mentioned the lion.
Oh, it'd be a long list, yeah. Boy, just almost everything. And again, that's what's great about the yak is so many species there. Great gray owls, golden and bald eagles, grizzly bears, black bears, marten, fisher, lynx. I've never seen a wolverine out the window, but I have seen a couple up here in the valley, snowshoe hares, so many different species of birds, different grouse, three different species of chickadees, geese, ducks, hummingbirds. It goes on and on. It's a very lush place.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Our guest this hour is Rick Bass, critically acclaimed author and committed voice for conservation. His new book, The Wild Marsh, records in detail 1 year of his family's life in Montana's Yak Valley. I mentioned your family. You have three daughters. How has it been like for them living where you do?
Well, I think about that every day, and you know, actually, I've got two daughters, and they're getting older now. They're 17 and 14. At the time this book was written, at the turn of the century, it was they were 8 and 5, and you know, looking back at those utterly innocent years, it was just, I think, a fantastic thing for them. And you know, I'll have to ask them when they're grown up, what do you remember? What do you think? But again, very isolated. They went to school in this little one-room log schoolhouse where it was grades kindergarten through 8 all together, and the older students helped the younger students, and the younger students moved up, you know, pretty quickly to learn at the older students' pace. And I think it was just wonderful. But we'll see. We'll ask them, you know, later on.
Do you think there were sacrifices inherent in living where you do, so isolated for your children?
Absolutely. I think, you know, and every parent does that, weighs the pro and con yearly. And, you know, the cons would be not so many other children to play with. But the friendships that they do develop up there, from what I've seen from other children who've gone to school up there last, you know, lifetime, and are real interesting in that they're across ages. It's more like a large family rather than the typical student relationships. You know, they go camping together in the summer. They go. It's hard to explain, but it was very much a positive, very much a pro. Once the girls got older, we did move them down to a larger school in town, 900 people, which, you know, for that social need, that we got down to 4 children in the school, and 2 of them were ours, and one was a kindergartner. So, you know, that was when it was time to, okay, you know, some socialization will be useful, you know, in this era. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, very, very sweet years when there were, you know, 10 or 12 kids of all different ages in that little log schoolhouse. I mean, the Christmas plays were so fun. The kids would be doing 2 or 3 parts at once.
Let me go to the phones here for a moment. Cambridge, Massachusetts is where Seth is calling from. Seth, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was reflecting on wilderness and posterity, specifically, and wondering exactly how we will reconcile the future generations, a degraded wilderness, and also a degraded climate. And, you know, growing up in southern New Hampshire, you know, I've personally witnessed reduced snowfall in the winters, and you know, I'm really sort of wondering, you know, how do we explain this to our children? You know, simply because there is going to be a displacement or a lack of connection with things such as snowfall or specific seasonal changes that the guest was speaking of earlier. You know, these very definite markers, things like you know, frozen, you know, lakes and ponds freezing and things like that. You know, and I'll take my question off here.
Thanks so much, Seth. You actually write about this, that there are less and less sensitive species around, less grizzlies and such, right, Rick?
Yeah, no, that's true. And you know, I'm so incredibly privileged to still live in a valley where nothing has yet gone extinct. I don't know of another valley in the lower 48 about which that could be said. I mean, even Yellowstone had its wolves eradicated for 60 years. And, you know, with that privilege, I do feel a sense of responsibility to convey to posterity how wonderful it is to be, and what it's like, just what it's like to be in that kind of ecosystem and to be living there, not just visiting it. And I like to think that will have value to readers in the future who are hungry for that kind of knowledge. The caller had an interesting and very bittersweet subtext, I think, to the question, you know, what's it going to be like for future generations who don't know that wilderness or that wildness or that diversity, that bounty? And I'm afraid the answer may be, you know, it's hard to miss something that you never knew. And I don't like to think that way, and it spurs my conservation efforts to make, you know, darn sure that we can take as many of these wonderful pieces with us into the future as possible.
Tell me about that conservation effort, because where you live in the Yaak Valley, you write about it's a critical gateway from the U.S. to Canada for wildlife, not people. But you also say in the book it's an ecological turnstile between Yellowstone, the Yukon, and it's not protected. After 45 years of the passage of the Wilderness Act, still not protected. I mean, how big of a part of your life, given your writing and everything that you're doing, is your conservation effort?
Well, second to parenting, it's everything. I mean, I dream about it the way you dream about, you know, parenting. You know, it's you know, I'm like some football coach or something doing X's and O's on the blackboard. I think about the corridors, the movements of individuals and also population genetics back and forth across Canada into the U.S. and east and west into the Cascades, into the Bob Marshall, down into the Cabinet Mountains and the Bitterroot and Yellowstone. The Yaak is the central gateway for all of the great ecosystems in the Northern Rockies, or what we call the Northern Rockies. I mean, in the United States Rockies, and you've got all of the Rockies of Canada up to the Yukon, obviously to the north. It's only about a million-acre landmass, but it is so totally integral to the comings and goings of all those other species. I mean, when I'm driving on a road, I'm thinking, okay, you know, how's an animal going to go from the Yaak to the Cabinets? Where do they cross? Local governments are starting to address, you know, this concept or need of corridors for migrating animals. But we're, you know, we have a lot of catching up to do. And again, as you said, nothing in the Yaak has been protected. The Wilderness Act of 1964 protected 10 original areas in the country where no machines would ever be able to go. And for 45 years, this wildest place in the lower 48, the Yaak, has not had one single acre in the wilderness system. So for, you know, 22 years, I've been working trying to get a bill into Congress that will help, that will protect some of the wildest places in the Yaak.
Back to the phones now to Idaho Falls, Idaho, somewhat near you, Rick. Here's Jason. He's on the line. Welcome to the program, Jason.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, well, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, are you there? Jason, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment just on what the caller was saying about being able to be out in nature and feel happy without having a reason. And I think that I grew up basically like a nice throw away from a river, and I could just go out and just be in, you know, in nature. And I think it's just a sense of stillness that you don't get in a city. And I think that basically city life tells you have to have a reason for everything. But I think that happiness kind of just comes from realizing your own like life force, and basically your own sense of being alive. And I think that being too crowded and having too much, that it takes that away. I think it's just the sense of quietness about nature, and the sense of, I don't know, just kind of connecting with that. So I'd really agree with the caller, or the speaker, that there is a difference. There are feelings you can't feel growing up in a city unless you get out and experience the quietness and peace and sense of purpose in nature.
Jason, thanks so much. Rick, do you ever long, though, to go back to the city? Are there times where you just, you know, would like a nice fast food meal or something else?
Yeah, I mean, and I actually, you know, we've got the girls in a you know, a larger school setting now, so we get into you know, into that, not city setting, but into, you know, into I guess urbanized or I guess I'll just say it, you know, crowded conditions. And it sure makes it sweet whenever we get back, you know, to the marsh and experience that stillness or that quiet. It's not even so much a quiet, because there's so much sound going on at different times of year, but it's a lot easier to find a good restaurant than it is to find the kind of stillness that the caller was talking about.
You mentioned before the break, Rick, some of what goes on in winter in the Yaak Valley. Take us through some of the other seasons. Take us to spring. And before you explain it, read from your book, what April is like.
Sure. It's not a long wait. The first frog tests his voice against the fading ice and snow on the first day of April. Not until the spotted frogs dare with their bravery to cry out against the season's long tyranny, even if their courage is the bravery of their ancient chilled blood, does winter seem, finally, able to be defeated. A bully melting quickly now at the first hint of the force of a superior heart. It is not really this way at all, but when that first frog begins to call, even while the marsh remains a mix of ice and snow and milky meltwater, that is how it seems. For all our lives, we've been told about and have accepted the four seasons and their neat symmetry. I don't know why the fifth season, the space between winter and spring, is never named, but it is certainly as real and seemingly enduring as any or all of the others. If it needs a name beyond the time when all the snow is gone but the ground remains brown and unchanging for weeks on end, I guess we could call it just that, the brown season or the mud season.
The slug-o-matic mud season, I think that's what you call it in one of the other chapters. The long brown night of the soul, April. Yeah. What's it like there?
You know, winter is really tough in western Montana. There's not much sun, a lot of gray skies, a lot of cold, a lot of, you know, fog in the valleys. And it just, you know, I think it's like concussions. I think that there's a kind of a cumulative effect. Each winter you just kind of, you know, get a little less bounce and a little less resilience, but it sure makes each spring when it comes just outrageously sweet. And again, you're humbled as a person. You're just beaten down physically and mentally by that absence of sun and life. You know, or the reduction of life. So many things have left. Color has left. Warmth has left. It just, when it comes back, it's you like it more each time.
Here's another call from Sarah. She's in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Sarah, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Rick. Just wanted to say how very lucky Rick is to be able to enjoy that wilderness. My dad lives in Hamilton down the Bitterroot Valley, and I have been lucky to be able to visit off and on for many years, and twice lived in the state, going to school at U of M for a year. In Hamilton, when I first started going there about 20 years ago, was, you know, had 2.5 lights. Now it has about 6 lights.
That's right.
Which is quite gross for Hamilton. And it's just that if I hadn't had that experience, I don't think I could have survived the 20 years that I lived in Manhattan. You know, to be able to go to that stillness, to be able to remember that there is this thing, nature, that I'm connected to, we're all connected to, that has greater importance than what shoes you're wearing.
So and why'd you leave? Why'd you leave, Sarah, and why don't you go back?
To Montana? Well, when I initially went there, I was still in my early 20s, actually my late teens, going to college. And at that time in my life, I wanted more city life. I wanted more of a social life. I just, the mountains felt they penned me in too much. Now, you know, I was in mountainous Montana. I haven't been to the Yaks. I'm presuming there's some mountains there, and I know eastern Montana is very flat because I've driven through it. Mm-hmm, but it was just a need for more culture at that point in my life. But now I'm in my mid-40s, and, you know, I think about being able to go and live somewhere off the grid, somewhere where, you know, you can see all sorts of animals, although have some type of protection against them, too.
Sarah, thanks so much. Thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it. Sarah mentioned Hamilton. I've actually been there. The number of lights that have increased and how the town has changed. How is the area changing, Rick? I mean, you see more people moving in. You see more people at least trying to get out and experience what you are?
You know, I do in the West around the you know, these little clustered zones of development, but not up in the Yak. It's almost all public land, almost all national forest, the Kootenai National Forest, and so there's very little private land available for home building and development. Just you know, a relatively small percentage, maybe 3% of the valley is private land from old railroad grants and homesteads. It's also not the Yak is not really a recreational or tourist kind of place. It's real low elevation, very wet, rainforest kind of country. A lot of swamps and marshes, a lot of mosquitoes and other insects in the summer and on into, you know, on into the early autumn. Low elevation, not those typical glacier or bitterroot kind of glaciated cirques and peaks, but more of an Appalachian softness to it. It's a biological wilderness, not really a recreational or tourist-driven wilderness.
Do you have a favorite time of year? Do you have a favorite time in the Yak?
I think I have three favorites. I think about it a lot, and you know, they're all each so wonderful. But I love May because it, again, that surprise of, wow, I'd forgotten you know, what it was like to not be in winter, and. And June is just June when everything's born and everything just, you can see the, you know, the growth almost hourly. June is really, really nice. And of course, autumn is great. You know, that first week of October is great anywhere in the country, really.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. My guest this hour is Rick Bass, critically acclaimed author and conservationist. His new book, The Wild Marsh, records in lush detail 1 year of his family's life in Montana's Yak Valley. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a comment from our website. Jane M. writes, "My husband and I visited Yak River 2 years ago in early summer. We took a driving tour of northwestern Montana. It was a fabulous trip, and we were struck by how friendly everyone was. My theory is that there are so few people in Montana that they're always happy to see you. Yak River was so interesting because so many people live off the grid and love it. We stayed at a lodge where earlier in the spring a grizzly bear had broken into a neighbor's freezer to eat frozen cookie dough." Sound familiar, Rick?
Yeah, except for the friendly part. I mean, there's a little window where people are just outrageously friendly, and a lot of it is, you know, the newness and oh, you know, winter's gone. Wow, look, there's a stranger. Wonderful. But you know, it's not a real social place. People, it's way back in the woods, and people have moved there for a reason, to be away from other people. And that's pretty much how it. That's kind of the general tenor of the place, but there is a little soft spot there, which evidently the correspondent hit nicely.
Here's Abe. He's in Spokane, Washington. Abe, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Rick. Thanks.
Hi.
Yeah, I just have a quote I'd like to read and hoping Rick would comment on by Margaret Murray. Speaking of a golden eagle she saw in what is now ANWR in Alaska, she says, "The mind is loose and emptied of all edged and clattered thoughts, goes freely floating out to meet the bird. We need such communion. We need to remember we are still animals." And I just have a sense that conservation today is such an uphill battle, due in part to the fact that our children are no longer taught we're part of nature. You know, they're no longer taught we're animals in this world. They are taught that due to technological advances, we're above nature. Do you have any comments on that, Rick?
Ed, thanks.
Yeah, sure. You know, you used the word taught, and you know, my experience is, you know, it's not even that complicated. Just when we have some space or wild country to exist in, kids get it. I mean, I've seen them get it, and adults get it, and I've seen folks from, you know, big cities who come out and visit and have never been in the woods. They get it, you know, within the first couple of hours. Just that paradox of feeling a greater connection to the world and while simultaneously understanding how infinitesimally minute one is in that relationship, and why such a realization should bring, you know, overwhelming peace or happiness. It really seems paradoxical to what we're taught about, you know, be significant, be big, be bold, be dramatic. And it's almost like a relief to stand in the fabric of a wild landscape where you realize, oh no, all bets are off. That's not how it is. And, you know, and hooray that it's not. Kids get that. That's the essence of childhood. I mean, you're not significant. You're not a world changer. You're not dramatic or bold. All you are is this tiny little thing with a big imagination. And that's maybe that's where that happiness comes from.
Here's Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. Kent is on the line. Kent, welcome to On Point.
Hello. I had a comment, and it's really great to talk to Rick. I used to live in Montana, but I bet there's a lot of young parents or parents of young children that are listening who would really like to commit to moving to the wilderness to raise their children like he describes, but just can't break free of their, you know, their normal life. And what I was going to say was, when I was a kid, I grew up in suburbs in Ohio and northern Florida, but it was always a new suburb on the edge of, you know, the developed world, so to speak, and there was woods and abandoned farmlands and the upper part of the bayou, and we had rowboats and bikes. And even as a grade school kid, I remember just a tiny little creek that amazes me to go back now, but we just spent all day, all summer, in that little creek and exploring the woods. And so if you are a parent and you live in a city and you can't make it out to, you know, Montana, you can still probably find a spot that has enough nature, if not wilderness, for your kids to really get a almost complete experience.
Mm. Ken, it's a good comment. It's striking that balance, isn't it, Rick?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It was that way for me, and it was that way for my children. You know, I'd want to share these wonderful places with them that, you know, would be way back in the country, these miraculous landscapes or animals or such. And, you know, they didn't need to go to the extreme experiences. They were just as happy, you know, splashing around in the marsh out in their front yard as you know, going to some distant place. When you've got that much imagination, even a little bit, scrap of nature will carry you, you know, where you need to go.
Mm. The yak, Rick Bass, is still very much a hunter-gatherer society. In fact, you say in the book that you are a hunter and that you'll never be able to explain the hunter's paradox. I'll read, "It's one of the most wonderful feelings of the season to shoot and take with you skill, bird from flight, to have your dog plunge into the icy, mist-steaming river and retrieve that beautiful bird, take it home and pluck it and clean it and prepare it for dinner." Can you be a conservationist and also a hunter, Rick Bass?
Absolutely. I mean, our wild country and or what we have left of wild country really comes from the work of hunters and anglers. And, you know, that's fortunately now in the conservation movement, we've got non-hunters helping, you know, in making great gains, but that is where the tradition came from, is from hunters realizing this is fantastic habitat. This protects the wild animals that I like to hunt, and you know, there's a very direct relationship there. It is confusing to some who don't hunt. They think, well, if you want to protect animals, then don't shoot them, don't kill them. But it's a question of scale. Taking an individual animal from a population does not affect the wild country that it lives in, and you know, if anything, it sharpens the population. But it's critical, absolutely vital, to have big chunks of wild country, or there won't be any hunters, there won't be any conservationists, there won't be anything that's what, you know, Wallace Stegner repeatedly told us was so quintessentially American. You know, this wilderness idea, the wilderness, and then the idea of the wilderness.
Here's Lauren. She's in Dracut, Massachusetts. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, well, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
I wanted to let you know how much I believe that your written work is as important as your active conservation work. Growing up as a child, one of the highlights of my youth is remembering the wonderful wilderness literature that my mother and father would read to me. And even though I couldn't be out in these very remote wild places, it really gave me a sense of appreciation for those places. And then as an adult, I got to firsthand experience that when I traveled to, believe it or not, Provincetown, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and was lucky enough to visit one of the artist's dune shacks out on the coast and experience that stillness and that awayness, away from people. And I'm having a daughter in October, and one of the things I plan on doing is reading your work and other great authors of American wilderness literature to her, so that even if I can't take her to a wonderful place like Montana, I can instill some sort of appreciation in the wonderful treasures that we have in this country. Mm. And I wonder if you got a sense of that work as being a vital part of your conservation work.
Mm. Lauren, thank you. Rick Bass?
Yeah, you bet. No, that's a lovely thought, and I don't mean to dismiss the tradition of nature writing and literature in shaping activist and policy and protection, but two of my great heroes are Terry Tempest Williams and Doug Peacock, and they are both just exemplary models of, you know, showing up for meetings and doing the you know, the frontline community work that stops the bulldozer, or that diverts the bulldozer, or protects the you know, the in-community work that's required for place-based specific conservation. Doug in particular is just, you know, he's got some funny saying, and I always get it backwards, you know, about one book is, one deed is worth 1,000 books or something, but I just can't, you know, in the underpopulated West, you just can't skip meetings. You need to show up and be involved in the projects. It's wonderful that you'll be reading to your child in October. I can't remember if you said a daughter or a child, but well, congratulations. But you know, when she gets a little older, take her to a meeting too. That'll be you know, a great. Then she'll have the whole gamut of conservation experience.
Here's Salim in Providence, Rhode Island. So Salim, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you?
Hi.
I'm one of those Americans that always felt that deep yearning to move out west. But I feel mine was triggered from actually a visit back east from where my grandparents are from. I'm originally from Lebanon, and my grandparents come from the mountainous region there. And I remember when I got to visit it in 2002, I woke up in the morning, one of the few mornings I've ever woken up extremely refreshed. And I just remember being able to breathe. And I looked out on the valley, which is called Kadisha Valley, which means the Holy Valley, and it's riddled with monasteries, and there's a history of saints that are from there. And my thought was that, well, of course people would find God here. It's that connection with the earth and with nature, and in the stillness, like a lot of other callers commented on. I felt a deep connection to my spiritual self, which when I'm in the city, and I live in Providence and commute back and forth to Boston, I feel that disconnect with nature kind of yields a disconnect with my own spirituality.
Mm, that's a really interesting point, Celine. Thanks. Rick Bass, is there a religious or spiritual connection for you in your own experience in the outdoors, in the Yaak Valley?
Yeah, well, I think the caller, you know, really identified the essence of it, as did a caller at the beginning of the hour. You know, we've got something in us, some spark, some fire, some consciousness, some essence, some being, but isolated as it often is in our culture, it, you know, expands into loneliness and confusion. When you start to edge beyond that and connect to the landscape that, you know, that shaped us and sculpted us and made us, you know, I think that's when you start to feel that spirituality and that, you know, that wonder, that also that joy, that that relief that, okay, I'm not alone. I'm very, very, very tiny, tinier than I realized, and yet, you know, part of something beyond my own furious absorption with self. And that's just, landscape gives us that. I don't think, you know, that spirituality, I don't think it's all, quote, ours, and I don't think it's all the landscapes either. I think it's a relationship between us and landscape, which, again, is so utterly vital that we protect our last wild places for that and so many other reasons.
Here's Elizabeth from Aiken, South Carolina. Elizabeth, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to that spark that Rick Bass is mentioning, I think that could be our own knowledge of impermanence that we do pass on, and that's easier to connect to in nature when you see things all around you in the tumultuous arena of life. And it gives us relief to recognize that and to acknowledge it. But I think that that knowledge could come to us in the city, that as conservationists, we should be encouraging people to grow potted plants on their porches and experience that kind of responsibility, keeping a pet even, having a garden, and our city parks. I think that there's plenty of places where if people realize the relief and joy you get from acknowledging our impermanence by experiencing nature in every arena.
Mm. Elizabeth, thank you. Thank you for your call. Here's Josh in East Boston. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for hearing me.
Sure.
I've been, you know, sort of hearing a lot of talk about the sort of environmental standpoint, and as someone who's, you know, been raised and grown up in a rural area of Maine, that's certainly an important aspect. But one that I'm sort of curious to hear from Rick, one that's really important to me, is more of a cultural and social preservation. I'm actually reading a lot of literature about Montana specifically, and how, you know, a lot of rich folk coming into rural areas, beautiful areas like the Bitterroot, et cetera, coming in and kind of changing the game and forcing the local farmers and local to kind of change their lifestyle. I'm wondering what his comment would be on that.
That's a great question. Josh, thank you.
It is a great question, and the rate of change, you know, in every acre of America has been so dramatic and will continue to be. The novelist Tom McGuane has a funny line about those rich folks buying up ranches. Say they make pretty good neighbors. You know, they don't overgraze the grass down to bare dirt. They don't cut down all the trees and have it erode into the creek. You know, he's being two-edged funny the way he can be. But preserving the cultural fabric of the place that you love, I think, is incumbent upon successful and really ethical environmental work in the rural West. In the Yaak Valley, we're certainly trying to preserve a logging culture where folks can still go out in the woods and harvest trees. I mean, the mills have all closed. They've gone out of business from not just the recession, but also the global competition. And it's very hard. You have to find very creative ways to employ people doing meaningful work, you know, thinning trees where they're overstocked, where you've got increased mortality from global warming. But we're doing that work, too. We're not just trying to protect the farthest, wildest places, but trying to keep the community as stable and diverse and traditional as is possible, because we, you know, we love everything about the place, or almost everything about the place.
Well, we're actually coming to Big Sky Country as a family this summer. I'll look up and think of you, Rick Bash. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. The Wild Marsh, Four Seasons at Home in Montana is the book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.